720 WGN. Our next guest, this guy's a stud. He's a Grammy Award winner. He's played drums for The Police, a band that sold over 75 million albums. He's conducting with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It's Stuart Copeland. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. I'm actually not conducting so much as blasting away on my drums, which actually is a form of conducting, considering the volume of my instrument.
Could you conduct if they asked you?
They probably wouldn't, but I do actually would like to conduct one day up in Albuquerque or something. The Albuquerque SO one day will be
right.
Cursed by my presence on the podium.
Well, tell everybody about the project with Ben-Hur.
Well, I'm here with the world's most incredible band of all, which is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And we're playing a movie, which is Ben-Hur, not the Charlton Heston one, which your listeners are probably familiar with. It's the precursor to that one. The Charlton Heston was kind of an art movie adaptation of the real one, which was made in 1925, and it has a cast of tens of thousands. It's the biggest silent film ever made. It's huge. They crash ships into each other, ships in flames, actual ships, not CGI ships or models, crashing into each other in the ocean in these battle scenes. The chariot race, the famous chariot race, is absolutely epic. It's huge, and since it's silent, that's very cool for a composer.
How did you choose Ben-Hur?
It kind of chose me. Quite a few years ago, I was commissioned to write the music for a stage production of Ben-Hur, where they do it in an arena. They have the whole chariot race, everything, even the battleship fight, on the floor of the arena. Huge production. And I wrote the music for that. The production did its thing, and there were all kinds of financial hassles. The stock, that was when the stock market crashed. And so there are all these problems. And long story short, I ended up owning all the music. I had to pay for, you know, the recordings in Bratislava and in Istanbul and so on. And I ended up, they weren't able to pay me, so I owned it all. And so I'm here in Chicago with that music that I owned and your big bad orchestra and this unbelievably big bad movie. It's huge. I mean, the world premiere of this was in Virginia. And the only galling thing about it was that there was I blasting away on my drums and this orchestra heaving magnificently. But the movie itself just draws your attention. It's so astonishing. It just sparkles on the screen.
Stuart Copeland in studio with us. How many soundtracks have you done? Have you done a lot in your lifetime?
Quite a few. It's a two or three closely spaced pages of titles there between movies, television movies,
right.
Television series.
Did you do Wall Street, the movie?
Yeah,
did I read that?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Quite a few, many, 40, 50. I lost count after 20 years of it.
Is that easy to do or harder to do than regular music? I guess it's all the same,
well,
but if you're writing for a movie or a television show.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by regular. You mean like rock music is real
right.
easy.
Right.
It's a little more technical than rock music, that's for sure, but not quite physically so demanding. And but it's hard because you have to be very specific. And 20 years before the mast, as a flinty-eyed for-hire composer, you learn some chops.
Sure.
You learn about what chords and what melodies create specific emotions. And, you know, like in a movie scene, the director, you know, there's a performance by one of the actors which just isn't convincing. And so call the composer. Look, we got to somehow make an honest man out of this guy. Or he's too convincing. You know, Tom Cruise looks into the girl's eyes and says, "I love you," and the audience needs to know that he's a lying, you know, he's
right.
a lying scumbag. Call the composer, and I put the bad chord over, you know, and so you learn to be very, very specific. You know, it's happy, sad. It has sort of a sheen of optimism and a sort of a whimsy, sort of a humorous whimsy, but underlying it is a sense of doom. And call the composer.
I got chills. With Ben-Hur, how many times do you have to see the movie, and is it really tedious because you have to time every, you know, every drum solo or every, you know, chord to a certain scene or a move?
Well, yes to all of that, except for the tedious part.
Okay.
It's really fun, actually. And the movie, the original movie, because they made movies, this is 1925. This is Boardwalk Empire. You know, those guys, you know, the people who made this movie look just like Boardwalk Empire. It was that era. And their competition was the opera, which were hours long. And so this movie was 2 hours and 40 minutes. They made people sit in the seats. And they had, so I had to cut it down to a more manageable 90 minutes. And so I was pretty deep into that movie. And I also had to curate it. The celluloid that we used, this 80-year-old print, remember this is 40 years before Chuck Heston.
Chuck.
It took 2 weeks to defrost. You know, Warner Brothers had this ancient print down in the vault. It took 2 weeks to defrost. And then we telecine it. It's the first time it had come out of the can since the 60s when they shot it for video. They made a video, which is a DVD that's available, made from video. But anyway, it's such a terrible medium. It's really ugly. But now, with modern technology, we got this movie out. We got this old lady out of her cans and telecine it to a much higher standard. And I had to cut this down and curate it because the print was a combination of several prints that have been out in the world, and they got the cleanest reels from, you know, and so there it's, I had to clean it up a lot as well as cut it down, curate it, and some of it was faded. It's not black and white, it's kind of gray and white. And but there's all kinds of techniques. They applied color washes. They didn't, you know, there's color in it as well. Early color, it was a transition phase of color. They didn't have three color, it was two color. They could do green and red, but not blue. And since this is actually a very religious movie in which the Virgin Mary plays a great role, her distinctive blue was a big problem for them. But it's still, this early color is kind of exciting to work with. So there was a big job of curation as well.
Stuart Copeland in studio with us. We're going to take a look at traffic and we're going to talk some more. You have an amazing story about how you were born in the United States and then moved over to the Middle East. I want to talk about that. And we'll talk about the police, too, coming up. This is your music right here. Don't miss Ben-Hur's MGM classic silent film with an original score composed and performed live by legendary drummer Stuart Copeland. You can go to cso.org/movies for tickets. He's in studio with us. You have a pretty amazing story growing up. You were born in the United States, is that right?
Yes, I was. I am a true American.
And then you moved over to the Middle East because your father worked for the CIA, is that right?
That's right. When I was 2 months old, I left my homeland, the land of my birth, the land of my American accent, which I had to acquire later, and went to Beirut, Lebanon. To Cairo first, and from there to Lebanon, which is where I did most of my growing up. And then from when my father's cover was blown in Beirut, he shipped his family out, and so I ended up in a British boarding school and didn't get back to my homeland until I was 18 when I went to college. And all that time, I'm American, gosh darn it, because in those days, Americans were beautiful. And we, all the old empires, the British Empire, the French, and all the others, the colonialists were all hated, but the Americans were very much beloved because what we did was education and benevolent acts of non-colonialism in those days. A lot has changed since then.
Mm-hmm. So you moved back to the United States when you were 18. When did you move back to England to meet Sting to form the police?
Well, I went to college in California, UC Berkeley.
Okay.
And just as I was about to graduate, I got a call that there was a band getting put together, kind of a, and one of the guys I knew and was saying, gosh, you got to do this. So I jumped on a plane expecting to come back. Didn't. The life of rock and roll grabbed me, took me up, and here we are 40 years later.
Well, I think it's interesting. When the police first started, you guys were considered kind of a new wave band, weren't you?
No, it was worse than that. We were a fake punk band.
Well, you got a lot of flack, and here you are 75 million albums later.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of worked out okay. But, you know, I was just too young to be a baby boomer. And just a couple years older than all those bona fide real punks who were at that time, they were 18 and they were snarling, but they couldn't play their instruments that well. And they didn't know how to book a truck, which I did know how to book a truck and I could actually make it to a show. You know, they would book, you know, the Rotten Eggs or Evil Edna's Horror Toilet, you know, all these punk bands. But they didn't know how to actually get to the show. So they'd call us at the last minute and we'd show up and the police would kind of fill in for The Damned or The Clash or whoever.
You know, we talked about writing music earlier. Was it easy to write these police tunes when you guys just started banging out hit after hit?
Well, the early part, the punk part, was real easy. E, A, and D chords. And I hate you, and you hate me, and it's all bad.
Right.
And then we got a real guitarist who actually had some harmonic sophistication. That was Andy Summers.
Right.
And Sting started to write actual sophisticated music, which kind of lifted us out of that world. In fact, we had been very much exposed by the British press in London as being a fake punk band. We were all 2 or 3 years too old. We were doing sessions. They knew that I had played in Curved Air, which was a prog rock band. And we were just a little too savvy. And so we came to America. And in America, they didn't know from, you know, actually Americans appreciated music. The Sex Pistols had come and gone and hadn't really made much of an impression. But we hit all the clubs and, you know, worked our way across America.
Right.
And were the acceptable face. And because of punk, the word punk had failed in America, the expression new wave was adopted instead.
When did you know that the police hit it? Like when you turned on the radio one day or you saw Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours singing Roxanne in the jail cell. When did you know?
Actually, incrementally, we hit it when we did our first headlining at the Marquee Club on Wardour Street, London. We are making it. We are here. We are now. This is it. It does. And then we played the bigger place. And then, you know, every step of the way felt like conquering the world. Okay, playing Shea Stadium,
yes,
sort of was a little bit more of a dramatic step than all the others, but each step felt like conquering the universe.
Well, you guys did Wrigley a few years ago. How was that? Was that fun?
Oh, it was a blast. It's fantastic. It's a unique stadium with all the buildings around and everything.
Right.
And to be there in that dressing room where those teams hang is something else.
Did they put you in the Cubs dressing room?
Yes.
It's a dump behind the scenes, isn't
well,
it?
Well, no, not
Dave, any, you've been in the you've been in there.
Well, it's small for a Major League Baseball team. I'm
couple
I'm,
things.
Yeah.
First of all, the magazines in the restrooms there.
really?
I didn't expect well, that.
They're baseball players.
I didn't expect that. But, you know, we go in there with our pipe and drape, which is they put these pipe frames and then hang silks. And then by the time I get in there, this dressing room for, right, you know, 20 guys is like my boudoir for one night. And I'm, you know, the only, except it's all very silky and beautiful with mood lighting. And
of course,
there's only three of us. So we each get our own palace, you know, backstage. Yeah. And yes, I suppose it's a little constricted compared to Giants Stadium. but, you know, this place has a lot of atmosphere and some pretty whack magazines, too. But, you know, so we create our own environment back there. But after the show, I go back into the shower room where the teams go, and I think and I thank the Lord above. I'm in the shower and I'm looking at all this. Now I'm in breeze block because they can't do pipe and drape in the shower room.
Yes,
there's like 20 shower heads in this big room, and I'm there by myself. And oh, I've just played a 2-hour show. Chicago rocked, and I'm just a happy guy. And I look around at those 28 shower heads, and I'm thinking, man, those guys, sometimes they lose a game. We never lose a game. We win every game. Game. And I'm a happy guy. And imagine if I was standing here with 20 other guys. Oh, if we won, great. But sometimes they lose games. That must be terrible.
It's like a high school locker room. It really
and
is.
It's a lot.
Yes. That's why they want to renovate Wrigley. What is in your rider, by the way? We have about a minute left. What do you have in your rider?
What do we have in my rider?
Yeah.
Gatorade. Yeah.
Just got to hydrate?
Yeah. Yeah. Fruit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will we see the police back together again on tour?
Who knows? Who knows? We always say no. That's what we said no for 30 years.
If you could do it tomorrow, would you do it? If they called you up, Sting said,
not
hey.
Tomorrow. I got a really good gig here in Chicago.
I mean, next month.
Now. I'm all sophisticated
now.
I got the Chicago Symphony Orchestra here. Well, I don't need those guys. I got 90 of the finest right here.
That's great.
Is it amazing, Stuart, that your music has just spanned generations and, you know, your kids and my kids and everyone's kids. So, you know, you're hearing the younger kids. And
nobody
then
saw that coming.
Isn't that
none
amazing?
Of us. Not the Rolling Stones, not us, not anybody. We never imagined in a million years that our music would survive the charts this month. And it was not made to last. It was made as fast food. It was made to be just a quick sandwich that you eat now and you enjoy, and then you make another one the next day. it never crossed anybody's minds that this music would survive. You know, because my generation, we didn't listen to our parents' music. My parents listened to big band jazz. It involved saxophones and trumpets and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And for my kids to be listening to the same music that I listen to, I have debates with my sons about Led Zeppelin, you know. They and they discovered Jimi Hendrix, and it's really quite miraculous. And I can tell you that all the musicians of, you know, those legacy bands, we are all very thankful.
Ben-Hur's MGM classic silent film with an original score composed and performed live by legendary drummer Stuart Copeland. You can go to cso.org/movies for tickets. Stuart, thanks for coming in. Really a pleasure to meet you.
It's been a pleasure. You got a really, your radio guys, listeners don't realize this, but you've got a prime spot here right on the street corner.
Right on Michigan Avenue. This is our office every single day.
Excellent.
No distractions ever.
A quick break at 720 WGN.